All right, we are going to discuss implementation issues. We will give the floor to you.
And it's Claire's first meeting, so it's going to be nice to her.
Yeah. Thank you.
Just this one.
In fact, Javed and I think it's going to be nice to us as well. Exactly.
All right, thank you. Agenda paper 12 summarizes the committee's November meeting. The committee had a productive meeting. It finalized one agenda decision and published tentative decision with helpful explanatory information on three other matters. So I'll first briefly talk about the tentative agenda decision. Sorry. Yeah, the tentative agenda decision start on page 2 of the IFPIC update. The first one is on IFRS 9 and relates to a consequential amendment that IFRS 9 made to paragraph 82A of IS 1. The other two tentative agenda decisions relate to the recognition of revenue in real estate contracts and whether an entity recognizes revenue at a point in time or over time. Both of these were practical application issues that we were made aware of, and the committee responded quickly to address these matters. For these issues, the committee published what is, in our view, very helpful tentative agenda decision. Both these decisions first discuss, in a more general and educated manner, how an entity applies the relevant requirements in IFRS 15, and then goes on to answer the particular question asked. Now, for both these agenda decisions, the committee considered whether the agenda decisions should only highlight the general principles and requirements, or whether the agenda decision should also go ahead and illustrate the application of those requirements to the particular fact pattern. On balance, the committee decided in favor of the latter. However, depending on the comments we receive, the committee may revisit this when it finalizes the agenda decision. Now, in addition to those tentative agenda decisions, the committee also finalized one agenda decision, which is on page 7 of the IFRIC update. It relates to the allocation of the transaction price for a group of assets that is not a business. In this instance, the committee concluded that a reasonable reading of the requirements could result in entities applying either one of two acceptable approaches, which are outlined in the agenda decision. Now, the committee considered whether it should undertake standard setting to address this matter. However, as outlined in the agenda decision, the committee thought that the benefits of standard setting would not outweigh the cost. However, the committee noted that the forthcoming amendment on the definition of a business in IFRS 3 could increase the number of transactions that are acquisitions of groups of assets. Accordingly, we will be monitoring this matter after those amendments become effective. Now, in addition to the final agenda decision and the three tentative decisions that I mentioned, the committee also discussed two other matters. Those two matters will be discussed in more detail as part of agenda papers 12A and 12C of this meeting. Accordingly, I will not discuss them further at this stage. I will stop here and ask if you have any questions on any of these matters included in the IFRIC update.
Will you also honestly tell us when the IFRIC has had an unproductive meeting?
It's not going to happen while I'm chairing.
That is why I need to hear it from you.
No, I mean, it's never going to be unproductive while I'm chairing.
That's why I don't want to hear it from third person. Okay, Amaru.
Just a quick comment on the report and the new way the committee is drafting its agenda decision. I really believe that the way, at least for these particular matters, the committee is trying to provide a more helpful and thorough assessment and how to apply the standard is very, very helpful. So I do probably not envisage this being in every case to have such a detailed agenda decision, but in some particular instances, I think it's very positive and very helpful, and I do appreciate that.
Well, I have an issue to raise in connection to one of the draft agenda decision, and it is the one that is displayed on pages 6 and 7, relating to a right to payment for performance completed to date in relation to IFRS 15 and revenue recognition revenue recognition over time. So, in fact, I tend to disagree with the conclusion reached. Naturally, because when I read IFRS 15, I can read a number of things. First of all, that the contract terms include the effects, not only the contract, but also the effects of laws and regulations, so that they're a set of contractual terms. And second, that IFRS 15 has set, and it presented that way, objective criteria in order to determine whether control passes over time. And among those objective criteria, you have the combination of the entity not retaining any alternative use to the asset and the right to payment. And IFRS 15 also provides supplementary guidance to indicate that the right to payment means the right to receive an amount covering costs and margin, and that the right to receive a penalty covering the margin alone is not sufficient. And when I look at the pattern that is submitted to the IFRIC, I can see that there is no decision of the customer that can deprive the entity from its right to receive full payment of the price agreed in the contract, that is full coverage for both cost and margin. And on that basis, I personally conclude that the right to payment criterion is met as well. On that basis, I disagree with the IFRIC conclusion. And I note that the IFRIC conclusion could be damaging in terms of comparability in the application of IFRS 15. I note that different countries have set different laws and regulations that allowed customers to withdraw from real estate purchase contracts. And in some of those countries, you can have the customers retaining, so having signed a contract exactly as that the customer here does, and they retain the right to sell their contract. So they make the decision to pass control to third party and to pass the obligation to pay the price to that party. And when I compare the situation in this agenda decision to that set of that other pattern, I can see a lot of commonality, and in particular, the fact that in both cases, the entity has the right to payment that covers cost and margin. And regardless, in fact, as to who ultimately pays the entity. So when the IFRIC makes the differentiating criterion being that the entire amount has to come from the first customer, I don't think, first of all, I don't think they relate to the criteria that we have in IFRS 15 properly, and I think they are putting their foot into getting entities report very differently their revenue recognition, even though they would be economically in similar circumstances. And so in the basis for conclusion, frankly speaking, I thought that the analysis could stop there because IFRS 15 itself says that it has set objective criteria, and when those criteria are met, you don't have to analyze further. But because I come in contradiction, I looked a bit further than that. And in the basis for conclusion, it is noted that in case of doubt as to whether control is passed, controls must be assessed from the perspective of the customer. And so I note that once the contract is signed, Nobody can deprive the customer from the benefit of the asset under construction, and ultimately of the delivery. So whatever happened in that fact pattern is decisions made by the customer being in control of the asset under construction. And again, what I indicated earlier in my view has to have primacy. There is no circumstance in which the entity can be deprived from the full price agreed by the in the contract with the first customer and covering both cost and margin. And that is on this basis that it is agreed.
Okay, so I've been writing, Francois, as you've been explaining. I've only made brief notes, but hopefully if it makes sense. Clearly, by the way, to add that this is in the context of a tentative agenda decision, which of course at the minute is subject out for comment. The comment period's open for 60 days. So in light of the comments that you made, we could certainly, as staff, because we will be taking a paper back to the committee that will summarise any comments we receive on the tentative agenda decision, and we'll certainly include your comment in that paper as part of the comments we've had in tentative agenda decision.
Thank you for that.
Mary?
Commenting in part because of Amaro's comment and partly because of Francois's. Something Amaro said, I think generally I get the longer the agenda decision gets, the more concerned I get about it. And to me, the primary purpose of the Interpretation Committee explaining its agenda decision is to try and draw out what the accounting question is. And if it thinks that standard setting isn't necessary, explain why that accounting question is answered, you know, adequately within the standard. And I do get a bit nervous when we start to answer, give an in your fact pattern, therefore the answer would be X. I am comfortable, having sat at the Interpretation Committee discussion of this, that the committee thought a lot about how to strike that balance, especially for a standard that was becoming effective and for issues where the in their view, and they are our eyes and ears on practice, that that this is something that potentially could be disruptive if not responded to very clearly. So I'm not disagreeing with the conclusion they reached about what should happen in this case, but I just kind of ask the staff to continue to be challenging as we find ourselves, if we continue to find ourselves drawn in for people asking for more and more, will we answer my question too? So I think it's just something we have to be cautious about generally. On Francois's point, again, having listened to the discussion, I'm comfortable that the committee thought hard about different aspects of this question and whether primacy really was on whether somebody remained committed to pay the purchase price. So I think it's good to have the views from the board table reported back, but in the first instance I'd say I'm comfortable that they had that fact in front of them when they considered this issue. So I think it's worth raising, good for them to know, but I don't expect it to fundamentally disrupt their consideration.
So
just building on this discussion about the length of agenda decisions, following the comment that Francoise made at last month's board meeting, I fed that back to the committee, and we were very explicit in the discussions about when the committee thought it was appropriate or not to be coming to a conclusion, as opposed to saying, look at paragraph A, B, and C and think about these things. And so that was a very explicit discussion that I encourage the committee to have, given the feedback that we'd had from the table, and it's something we need to think carefully about. I raised the concern that we need to be careful not to get to a situation where people are sort of encouraged to send in their term sheets and ask the committee for sign off on the correct accounting, which I think is a risk if we do too much of this. But I'll be interested to see the feedback that we get from the comment letters to decide the way forward on these, all, you know, the three tentative agenda decisions on IFRS 15 in particular, which have tended to be longer than usual. But having said all of that, I must say my heart is probably partly in, very much in Amaro's camp, because I think in the structure and effectiveness review that we had recently, we got a pretty clear message from what I remember, that people want the committee to be as helpful as possible. And the committee saying that there's adequate guidance, therefore we decided not to do standard setting, is not considered to be helpful. And generally, when I go out and about, maybe because I chair the committee, but generally people say positive things to me about these styles of agenda decisions. Now, I think there can be a difference between us getting to the answer and saying, therefore, the accounting is this, and sort of stopping before that, but having done a thorough analysis of these are the steps you need to go through and these are the considerations you need to make, and those two things are both helpful, but one's going further than the other. But I think we need to also remember that we've got loads of people out there in the real world that don't have the benefit of all the background and skills that we have around this table, who are picking up these new standards, which are quite difficult standards to apply, and they really just need extra help to have a roadmap to walk through these standards. And we're trying to do that to support consistent application. So we'll listen very hard to the feedback we get and make sure, and I'll reiterate the comments again when we have the discussion with the committee on these agenda decisions. But I think we do need to be mindful that there are plenty of people out there who think that this is actually the right way for the committee to be going.
That's right.
I certainly agree that the committee would be helpful help people find their way through the guidance that is given in the standards. I support that very much. But giving answers, in my view, is not the right thing to do. And how well a fact pattern is being summarized, there are elements that on which it remains silent, and that can have their impact in the decision that should be made. And also, the staff has often told us that including illustrative examples in standards had the disadvantage that people apply those illustrative examples by analogy instead of exercising their judgment. And I think when the IFRIC comes to an answer, it opens the door not only to having other requests put to the IFRIC, but people, in fact, stopping, thinking closely enough, analyzing enough their specific set of facts and circumstances, and stopping exercising judgment. And maybe you're going to have many more people doing the same thing, but eventually many of those people will do the same thing when, in fact, they should be doing different things. And so I think it may affect the quality of financial reporting negatively.
Which are fair points, but I think we also need to make sure that we have given enough guidance in these decisions that we really are going to help people get to consistent understanding of the standard and don't leave open questions and really not move us forward. Mm-hmm. And we have to find the balance between those.
I think some of this, and I say this only if it's maybe reassuring and maybe not. It only says exactly, Francis, what you say. When the board decides to include illustrative examples with any standard, every time we are now producing any, which are non-authoritative or well, whatever, but it's trying to do something to help people. When people are reading the requirements, just trying to help them work out how they should go about reading them and what order, etc. All that you say is true, which means that one approach we could take is never do any illustrative examples, never, go as far as that. I know that's not what you're suggesting, but all it says to me and any standards I've worked on is that there's an incredible, we need to be very careful then when we do it and how we do it and the rigor we put behind it. And for example, what are the facts that we spell out that support the conclusion, etc. To ensure at least, in terms of how we write it, we've been as careful and done as thorough a job as possible to make sure, we spelled out the right facts, we're not including facts that don't make a difference, that we're linking the conclusion back to exactly what are the words in the standard, etc. It says we need to be very thorough and be very careful. And every time we do it, there are risks associated with that. But I think it's just part of us, and Sue's commented. getting the balance right, I suppose, and then thinking based on the feedback we had about trying to provide, you know, more information in the sense if we could, and trying to help people apply our standards. We I suppose it's just part of what we're doing, and we just need to be careful in doing it, Jen, and not push too far.
We hear each other. Okay, that's very nice thought. Okay, let's continue.
So those people should move on to 12A.
Yeah. So agenda paper 12A is about the cost considered in assessing whether a contract is onerous applying IS 37. So the Interpretations Committee has received a request to clarify the meaning of the term unavoidable costs, IS 37 definition of an onerous contract. And this request was prompted by the withdrawal of IS 11, including its specific onerous contract requirements for certain contracts from the 1st of January 2018. So paragraphs 4 to 8 of our paper provide more information on the request that the committee received. As I'm sure many of you, all of you are aware, that the board has a project on IS 37 and its research pipeline, and this project is intended to consider various problems with IS 37 identified by the board, and included in that is the diverse interpretations of the term unavoidable costs. And so a history of the committee's discussions about this request are outlined in paragraphs 9 to 16 of our paper. And at its November meeting, the committee decided to add a project to its agenda to clarify the meaning of unavoidable costs in the IS 37 definition of an onerous contract. The committee intends to consider the technical issues at a future meeting. However, because of the interaction with the board pipeline project, the committee also decided to ask you if you have any comments on or any questions about the committee's decisions to date and its planned next steps.
Any questions? Comments? Nope. All right. Well, be quick. Well done.
We are actually continuously going in order of papers just to hopefully keep it straightforward. So it is 12B next.
Thank you. Agenda paper 12B, the short paper, discusses the transitions for the proposed amendments on IS 8 to accounting policy changes. As outlined in our analysis in paragraph 4, we recommend entities apply the amendments prospectively to any changes in accounting policies resulting from a gender decision. I would like to direct your attention to the question on page 2 and ask if you agree with our recommendation.
Oh, Mary.
Quickly, it wasn't clear from the paper. To me, I think it's gotta be explicit that you cannot apply this change retrospectively, as opposed to just saying you are required to apply it prospectively.
Can we support this?
14.
Okay. All right.
Good job.
So I'll see you.
Keep moving. So agenda paper 12C.
Okay, so agenda paper 12C discusses the committee's discussion and recommendation relating to the application of IFRS 1 when a subsidiary adopts IFRS standards later than its parent. More specifically, whether such a subsidiary can apply paragraph D16A of IFRS 1 to measure cumulative translation differences using the amounts reported by its parent. The committee published an agenda decision on this matter in September 2017, it's finding that the exemption in that paragraph does not apply to cumulative translation differences. The committee also decided to research possible narrow scope standard setting for components of equity when a subsidiary becomes first-time adopter later than its parent. This was in response to feedback on the tentative agenda decision on this matter. At its meeting in November, the committee discussed such possible narrow scope standard setting and decided to recommend that the board propose an amendment to IFRS 1. Paragraph 17 to 33 of the paper discusses the scope of the project. Based on the discussions, the committee agreed with the staff recommendation that the scope of the project should be limited to cumulative translation differences. In considering the potential benefits and costs described in paragraphs 34 to 39 of the paper, the committee concluded that the potential benefits of undertaking a narrow scope standard setting on this matter are likely to exceed the potential costs. Consequently, the committee recommended that the board propose an amendment to IFRS 1 to provide additional relief relating to cumulative translation differences. Paragraphs 40 to 44 of the paper discusses whether such relief should be provided as an option or requirement for a subsidiary that applies paragraph D16A. For the reasons described in paragraph 42, we recommend that the board make the proposed relief a requirement for such a subsidiary. I would like to highlight that what we're proposing here is that the proposed relief will be a requirement only if a subsidiary elects to apply the exemption in paragraph D16A, which we see as being consistent with how the exemption in that paragraph works. If you apply that exemption, you have to apply that exemption to all assets and liabilities, and you cannot choose which assets or liabilities to apply that exemption to. And lastly, paragraphs 45 to 47 of the paper discusses annual improvement criteria. Based on our analysis, we think the proposed amendment to IFRS 1 meet the requirements for annual improvement criteria. Therefore, we recommend that the board include the proposed amendment in the next annual improvement cycle. The questions for the board are on page 14 of the paper and asks whether you agree with the staff recommendation to first propose amendment to IFRS 1 to require a subsidiary that applies paragraph D16A of IFRS 1 to measure cumulative translation differences using the amounts reported by its parent, and second, include such a proposed amendment in the board's next annual improvement cycle. Hand over to the board for discussion.
Takashi, I have 3 points on this. One is, in the context of an overall support for going ahead with the project, so it's about how rather than should we. First is, I think it would be helpful, the analysis in paragraph 36 talks about why it would be good to do it from a preparer perspective. I think there's maybe some consideration that didn't get captured here about assessing the impact on from the user perspective on the financial statements of making this change, and maybe just making sure that we capture that as well, because I think the conclusion was there's relief for payers without any negative consequence for users, but we should capture that and not just focus on one side. The second is, I really was questioning your recommendation in that it be a mandatory extension of paragraph D16. I think if the objective is to provide relief, and we think that the current requirements, which said, of IFRS 1, which says you have an option for the assets and liabilities, but you're not allowed to, to reset the CTA as we're proposing, that, since we haven't said, oh my word, that's been what's happening, it's horrible, we have to fix it, to me that argues for an option rather than a requirement, because it makes both D16 a bit more complex. If we think people will normally elect it, let them work through that in into bits. And the third point is about making it an AIP. Again, going back to the fact that we had a discussion at the Interpretation Committee, and the view of that was that there's not ambiguity in the standard, but the committee subsequently went back and said, but do we think that this is an opportunity for improving the standard? I tend to think of AIPs as more as resolving unintended consequences or conflicts that have been identified, rather than deliberately introducing a change in requirements to the standard. And you know, maybe I just have too narrow a view of AIP, but that's what made me. I think it's the scale is AIP, the sense of it is AIP, but when I stand back and think about how we've used it, I question whether it should be an AIP. Because that to me would signal, well, you could have gotten there before and we're just kind of confirming your ability.
I think we've got a pretty loud message from our stakeholders that they prefer us to package things together rather than issue like a scattergun approach of different amendments. So I'd just go with an annual improvement, and annual improvements do introduce changes. They're just, you know, on the periphery rather than a big deal. So I actually think that bundling it with the annual improvement just probably is neater and makes sense. And on the option, I wouldn't go with an option because we hate alternatives. So why would we throw one in here in the middle of everything else?
It's IFRS 1. That really is what I come back to. I take a different approach when it's IFRS 1.
I think if I just add a point there, I don't know if it's helpful, Mary, but part of our thinking here is just to be clear, and the reason I want to make it clear is the reason we've put option versus requirement, and it looks like we're recommending requirements, so you're always forced there. Just to let you know, entities are not forced. This is just a requirement within an exemption. So it's not that overall they're forced to do it. It's just if they choose to take that exemption, it's an embedded part of that.
So are your choice.
Doug?
Thank you. First of all, I would like to appreciate the quickness of this amendment proposal, because we just discussed only a couple of months ago about the agenda decision, and then you came up with a proposal, and I quite agree with doing it with quite limited scope, just the CTD, and the require it. Everything is fine. One question is, this is to eliminate that two sets of different carrying amount, and that it will work prospectively. How about those who has already applied IFRS 1 in the past? They still keep carrying two carrying amount. And if it's only limited to CTD, is there any possibility that to provide some help to make it in a single carrying amount? Because those who applied from maybe next year can have one single carrying amount. But those who have applied this year, then they need to have two carrying amount, in a sense, forever, as long as they keep that subsidiary. So that doesn't really help under a very uneven treatment. So, of course, I think it's difficult to apply it retrospectively. But because it's only limited to CTD, and just having a two carrying amount make it one, I don't think it's quite difficult to allow them to make it just one carrying amount. So it's just, is there any possibility to think about it?
Personally, I think it would not be that hard from a standard setting perspective, mm-hmm. and it would be quite unhelpful for preparers. But as mm-hmm. Mary said, in terms of the user side, if we allow that and the subsidiary chooses to apply that requirement, the cumulative translation differences suddenly changes from the prior year. So they would lose the trend information. So from that perspective, maybe it is not quite a useful measure from the user's perspective.
But the retrospective application is to provide transition information clearer. So then, for example, if you have two subsidiaries, one is you acquired this year, the other you acquired last year, that the other acquired next year. So then one has one single carrying amount, the other has two carrying amounts. So in order to make it consistent, having a retrospective application makes more sense rather than...
We haven't actually recommended anything on transition specifically, have we? So we can have a look at that.
So I was just going to explain the tech. I suppose the question on the table for you today is whether you agree that we would propose to amend IFRS 1 on this basis. What this paper, I think what you bring up is something we should consider, which is essentially transition. And what, you know, do we think this amendment should only apply going forward or backwards? But we haven't brought transition to you as part of this.
I just comment on that one, because I think it would actually be quite difficult to do, because what you'd be doing is apply it retrospectively to somebody who'd applied IFRS 1 in the previous year. I think it would actually be quite difficult to write that, and also to make sure that they realise that it applied to them, because they wouldn't even be reading the standard.
Can I ask a question on this, because I understand Tak's comment and I'm sympathetic on the operational aspect, but to go to how long before the application? So at the end of the day, in a group that is formed along the 150 years, you still have a number of companies that would carry on to distinct numbers or set of accounts. So, and this is the difficulty. You give some relief to companies in the last 2 or 3 years, but not the others. So.
Anyway, we have to analyze.
Yeah, so what I was going to say was it's definitely something that we will come back and talk to you about, but let's consider it in the paper and everything mentioned here as part of
what
we can.
Can we support the staff recommendation?
14.
Okay. So this was the last time that Takashi is sitting at this table, at least for now.
Yeah.
And, we thank you for your big efforts here in the last 2 years. You're going back to Japan. And befittingly, you finished with a Japanese issue.
I think it's supposed to be anonymous.
Japanese origin is always betrayed. Okay, well, we wish you all the best.
Thank you very much.
Okay, final paper, 12D. Feedback paper.
First time Vincent as well.
No.
The board meeting is.
That's all? Yes. We will be very nice to you, so...
Okay. I just got nice, not very nice.
That song is French. And
thank you.
We now move on to agenda paper 12D, which provides a summary of the feedback on the proposed amendments to IAS 16 regarding proceeds before intended use. Those amendments would prohibit deducting from the cost of PP&E any proceeds generated through selling items produced before the asset is available for use. Before discussing the feedback, as a reminder, the proposed amendments originated from a submission to the Interpretation Committee. Having identified diversity in how entities account for the cost of PP&E, the committee discussed various ways of addressing that diversity, which were explained in the basis on the ED. We received 71 comment letters. Many respondents either disagreed with or expressed concerns about the proposed amendments. We will discuss this concern shortly. Other respondents, however, agreed with the proposed amendments and said they would provide relevant information by giving a clear view of both an entity's revenue and cost of PP&E. The purpose of our session today is to provide you with the main feedback from respondents. We are not asking the board to make any decision. One of the main issues raised relates to cost allocation, as discussed in paragraph 15 to 21 of the staff paper. many respondents said the requirement to separately identify costs that relates to items produced and sold before an item of PPE is available for use would present significant practical challenges and would introduce additional judgment. However, a few respondents thought that entities should be well positioned to make these kinds of judgments. Another issue mentioned relates to the exclusion of depreciation from the cost of the items produced and sold before an item of PPE is available for use. This is summarized in paragraph 22 to 26 of the paper. Here, many respondents said that excluding depreciation from production cost would distort the unit cost and margin of an entity's operation and would thereby affect comparability. Some respondents also disagreed with the observation made in the basis in the ED that any consumption of PPE before it is available for use is likely to be negligible. I would like to pause here and ask whether you have any question on those two first topics.
Vincent, thank you for the paper and summary, and I think it's broken down quite well. I have three observations. One is, I think it is important that we move ahead and do the, which to me is a fundamental clarification. I think it's covered by the section about to be capable of operating in the manner intended by management does not include financial operating targets. And so to me, that's just a really core thing that we're trying to do. And it seems that all the feedback is around the operationality of operating, you know, in the manner intended. Mm-hmm. The second point is, and I think I get to credit Petrina with this, is that a lot of the concerns are about how you do the cost allocation. That's what you've summarized here.
Yes.
And I think that the proposals in this would align with requirements of U.S. GAAP, which implies that under U.S. GAAP, we should have a way of doing this allocation in a way that isn't the end of the world as we know it. So is there anything we can learn from what that guidance is and what the practice is that might help respond to some of these comments? And then the third is what I see as an inherent tension between some of the comments, which is do this having the sales proceeds from testing byproduct because it doesn't might not have full costs will distort the margins. If that's the case, for something to distort the margins, it strikes me that it has to be a big enough volume that it's something that I should care about. If it's such a small volume because it's only the testing phase, then I don't see how it could be enough to distort the margins. So that's just maybe a tension to explore for bring back the analysis and recommendations.
Gary, very good paper, by the way. Just a couple of tangential questions in here. And paragraph 12, many respondents expressed concern of proposed amendments. And it goes on to say they review a more comprehensive solution. Expired. Are they just talking about narrowly inside of proceeds from developing PPE, or are they talking more holistically about PPD accounting in general, or what do they have in mind there?
I can actually answer, yeah. There is some of this discussed later in the paper, but they were focusing on like PPE when it was in the construction phase, so available for use concept. Unit of account came up in a few ones, so arguably that's broader. But it was all to do with that kind of pre-production phase. But instead of just looking at the treatment of sales proceeds, they said, well, you can't address some. Respondents said, well, you can't address that unless you also address available for use. And then if you're doing that, you should also be looking at unit of account. And then conversely, on the flip side, there were some other respondents who said, no, you should just narrow the scope of the project completely. But they didn't get into
you know, the, all the other paragraphs in IS-16. So.
Okay, because during the development of this, actually,
yes.
Support, you know, the ED, you know, trying to draw back on memory, we would not have, during the, when you're having revenue during the development phase, we would not have a depreciation expense,
yeah.
But you'd recognize the other costs. Is that?
Exactly, yeah, until you get to that available for use, that's kind of your, or yeah. Operates in a manager and tenant by management, that's your kind of trigger for when you kickstart your depreciation. So it's interesting reading some of the respondents' comments saying, depreciation should be included, but we're looking at revenue before the point in time at which you.
So you have other incremental costs, but not
mm-hmm.
depreciation.
Exactly.
And by the way, holding off the depreciation until it's ready for use actually makes sense to me mm-hmm. because, you know, developing assets and testing them and, you know, salvage some few dollars out of it. I think that's just part of the cost of building these things. So I think I think the ED had a reasonable set of things, but just like you don't start depreciating many other assets before they're ready for use or put into use, depending. And I think that should make this, we should stick with that here too as we develop this further. Thank you.
Thank you.
Doc? In the GPF meeting, I heard a very interesting reaction. Some of the GPF members said if they have to apply this standard, they will not sell the production during the testing field. So of course it's better to sell because they can earn cash. In terms of cash flow, they understand it's beneficial to sell it by products. But once you sell it, then you have to do the cost allocation. Then normally the products during the test period is not priced as high as their normal production, so it's better off than just scrapping it. So then, if they made a cost allocation in the accounting profit and loss statement, they have to suffer losses. So if that is the case, they would prefer not to sell. So that would, maybe this accounting standard could change some behavior of preparers. I don't know whether it's prevailing things or not, but reaction indicates how difficult this proposal is, because we do not provide any guidance about cost allocation, and then all of a sudden cost allocation would be an issue for the products during the test period. And then we have to be careful about the effect of this standard, because we try to address some issue which was raised by submission. Then maybe this proposal could be a good answer to address those issues submitted by some preparers or some constituents. However, this issue may relate to the lots of population, because this would affect standardized cost. So we need to make a kind of, you know, the population analysis or effect analysis. Otherwise, it's a bit dangerous. That is what I felt after I read your feedback statement. Do you have any plan to do that? You mentioned a little bit about effect analysis.
It was one of the comments that was actually raised, and I think was put in our paper. We haven't yet determined whether or not we'll.
Okay.
Our next step was to bring we wanted to update the board on where things were at, and then our next steps are firstly we want to get more feedback from some of the respondents, and as part of that we'll also consider effects analysis.
Yeah.
Yes, but regarding that effect analysis, we should also find the fact that when the issue was discussed at the interpretation committee, the staff at that time also lead outreach activities
mm-hmm.
that show that there were diversity in practice with regards to this issue. So actually we know that in some it is more prevalent in some industry, and that this issue is especially material for those industries. So actually, regarding the effect analysis, part of the job has already been done.
Yeah.
when it was discussed.
And actually, interestingly, at least if when you read the comment letters, I think a lot of that is confirmed. By the way, don't get me wrong. Some comment letters are saying, "I'm not sure." You know, you imply on the basis this only affects a few industries. I'm not sure that's the case. But at least when I read some of the letters that come from the extractive sector, both particularly mining, but also oil and gas, also petrochemicals were mentioned. The comment letters from those industry sectors were also confirming, though, that there is diversity and how and how the accounting works today in the context of the conflict.
So somehow you have at least idea of effect already.
And obviously, so obviously effects are always built up all the way along. So I think we have good information already, but that should be enhanced as we do more.
Good.
Thank you.
If you pursue this project, I think there should be the possibility, depending on the facts and circumstances, to either account for revenue and cost of production along IFRS 15, IFRS 2, but also open the possibility for accounting for a net gain in the statement of performance, because when the products of the testing phase have nothing in common or not much in common with what is going to be ultimately sold to the end customers when indeed the production runs, I don't think they belong to a flow of revenue and of cost of sales, and they would better be separated out. And a number of issues regarding the cost of location would disappear.
Gary?
Back under cost allocation, I mean, if you take the example of depreciation, we're leaving off because we're waiting until it's ready for use. But if you think of the cost of the capitalized asset as a sunk cost, and so you know, the rest of cost allocation, I'm trying to envision, well, what other costs would have to be allocated? Of sort of, I would think, identifiable direct costs of shipping, handling, freight out. I would think that'd be pretty straightforward. If you have labor, you know, doing this stuff, you would think that's measurable, and maybe it's capitalized, maybe it's not. So I think as we progress to this thing, we need to understand what do you mean by costs. If we've excluded a sunk cost, a depreciation, should you keep it to fixed and sunk costs separately? And we only deal with this. One point on paper 12A, we ought to try to coordinate the work. We talked about unavoidable costs and went through two choices, you know, incremental costs and costs you can't avoid because you got the contract. We actually could probably work these two simultaneously in concept anyways, maybe not practical at the staff level, but they are answering a question about incremental costs in 12A. So I could certainly see a case where you should expense incremental costs. That implies sort of variable type costs where you can identify the payroll or the payables or something. The other thing is reckoning, actually I hear what Tak said, some people will not sell it. I need some proof that really is pervasive. If you've got a 10-year development project, you know, and doing some, you know, field, I just have trouble. You're going to walk away from 10 years of cash inflows. I mean, plus you get the practical problems. Well, we're going to store all this stuff. Yeah. I mean, it's one thing if it's a one-year development, yeah, you can carry it.
But don't give it away.
Yeah, you know, well, you still got the cost allocations, the freight out, you know, the handling. So I just, you know, you hear that stuff a lot in standard setting, but commercial reality sets in at some point in time, too, you know, about the...
Not in all regions of the world.
Okay. Continue, Vincent.
Merci. Another topic raised, further described in paragraph 42 to 35 of the paper, relates to the assessment of whether the proceeds generated before an item of PP&E is available for use are hotspot from an entity's ordinary activities. Some respondents disagreed with the observation in the basis in the ED that such proceeds are part of an entity's ordinary activities. However, those respondents had differing views on what the appropriate treatment should otherwise be. Some respondents said this justified not recognizing the proceeds in profit or loss. Some others said such proceeds should be recognized in profit or loss, but should be presented separately from revenue or otherwise subject to additional disclosure requirement. Another topic raised is described in paragraph 36 to 40 of the paper and relates to the interaction of the proposed amendments with other standards. In relation to the interaction with IS 16 itself, several respondents said that recognizing the cost of producing items in profit or loss would conflict with the requirements in IS 16 to capitalize any cost directly attributable to making the asset available for use. With regards to the interaction with IS 16 and IS 2, several respondents questioned what abnormal costs are in the context of testing activities. A few respondents also asked the board to clarify whether the proposed amendment would affect assets recognized applying IFRS 6. This is because some entities in the mining and extractive industries also credit proceeds received during the exploration and evaluation phases against the cost of the related assets. Before moving to the last issue and the planned next steps, we would like to know whether you have any question on the topic we have just mentioned.
That is not the case.
The last topic we will mention relates to the overall direction of the project. The comments are summarized in paragraph 41 to 47 of the paper. Many respondents suggested the board undertake a more comprehensive project on PP&E. This is because, they said, there are a number of interrelated issues that should be addressed. A number of respondents specifically asked the board to clarify when PP&E is available for use because, they said, there is significant diversity in how entities determine this. Some also said the existence of material proceeds might indicate that the asset is already available for use. Another issue raised relates to the unit of account and identifying the asset or component thereof that is available for use. In contrast, some other respondents suggested the board limit the scope of the project further, while others said no amendments to the IS-16 requirements are necessary, other than enhanced disclosures requirements. Based on the feedback we received, the planned next steps are for the staff to follow up and obtain additional detail on some of the topics raised in the comment letters. This will enable us to determine how best to move forward on the project. We then plan to seek input from the committee before coming back to the board at the future meeting. I will now ask whether you have any question on the respondents' feedback and on the overall direction of the project.
We are completely convinced.
Yeah, and just to say around the next steps for me in particular, and this is just having a look through the comment letters, I think it hopefully it comes across in this that there are really quite, you know, wide and mixed views coming at, you know, this amendment from different angles. But I suppose for me personally, I can read that. I can read that it's, oh, cost allocation is difficult. You should focus on a different line. But what we don't get from just the comment letters is, to me, we need to dig a layer deeper to understand a bit better, well, when is cost allocation a problem? Where, you know, where is the problem? When, you know, what do you think the solution is? Why do you think we should focus here and not there? So I think for us on the next step, we just need to get a layer deeper than what we can read sort of generally across the comment letters.
All right. Well done, Vincent. We take a break till 10:03.